morning, everyone. The Customer Service Operations Safety Committee meeting is called to order. There not being a quorum present, we'll move to the initial reports. And the first one is the quarterly safety and security report. Mr. Barlow?
Yes, sir. Before we get started, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to let the committee know that we've been simulcasting these committee meetings, and I'm told by staff that some of the board members are not being heard because they're not, you don't have the microphone directly in front of them, so I just would ask that we be mindful of that.
Mr. Gadeen is going to bring us to the first presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gadeen.
Good morning. I'd like to take you back the past 6 months and where we stand in terms of our safety performance. Overall, the data is good, favorable. If you look at the first page, it basically unchanged in terms of rail passenger injuries with the incident rate with the 6% increase in our ridership. You can see that basically the equalizer is the rate, and it was unchanged, as was the next indicator for rail transit facility occupants, which are really our station-related injuries. They were unchanged rate-wise. And you look at the raw numbers, they're really de minimis. Escalator injuries, they did increase slightly, but it's important to note, however, that majority of these accidents that occurred on escalators were human factor related, not mechanical, electrical in nature, in terms of the escalator failing. It's also favorable to note that just about eight straight years now, we have not had one fatality on an escalator. It was not the story 8 years ago when we had two fatalities involved with two Mount Vernon and Judiciary Square. You put those safety devices in the comb plates, and sometimes they do affect the reliability of the escalator, but the trade-off is we haven't had a fatality since then. We had two that year before we installed them. But overall, when you look at the end of the day, we could pretty much say that 99.9% of our Metro rail customers arrived at their destination safely. Focus, what do we need to work on? We still need to work on door-related injuries, claims, and also escalators, and we'll continue that for the remaining months as well as going into the new fiscal year. We have a risk management approach model that we use, and it's been successful in the past. For example, years ago, it wasn't uncommon to have people drop between the two cars, particularly visually impaired. They would mistake the gap between the cars as an open door. We put the inter-car barriers, those chains between the cars, and we haven't had an incident since then. Also, it was uncommon to have severe leg injuries with the gap between the platform and the actual train. We put spacers at the threshold of the doors, and you don't see those type of injuries we had in the past as well. Fires, if you look at the fires, we used to have high double-digit fires with in excess of 20-minute service delays. We don't see that anymore either. There were no derailments in the last six months, nor were there any collisions to report. When we look at the semi-annual operation indicators, station overruns, violations, I'm going to ask my colleague, Taka Salpeas, to come up and address the precision stopping issues because that was covered in the Post last Saturday. So from a standpoint, the numbers are higher, but if we look closely at the past month, as far as January compared to December, they went down better than 50%. So I'd like Mr. Salpeas to explain what's going on with the precision stopping.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. We told the board back on March 31st that we're going to finish this program in December 06. We made it very clear that the first year, 05, it will be the year which we develop the fix, engineer the fix, test it, and accept it. For your information today, and I'm going to give you more details on March the 2nd, when we have the semi-annual update of the rail cars. As of December 31st, we finished the fix, the testing of the acceptors for the red line. Red line stations have been all cataloged, have been incorporated into software for the 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and 5,000 series cars. And now we are moving on to do the same thing for the orange line, for the 1,000 orange line, green line, yellow line, for all the series of our rail cars. And here you can see the 1,000 series will be done March, April, the 2,000 series May, June, the 3,000 July, August, the 5,000 September, October, and the 6,000, it will be done. We start modify the software of them as soon as we accept them from the testing, which, as you know, they are going out. That starting sometime in April, you're going to see gradual improvements to the station overall. But the project supposed was planned to be done by the end of 06, and it will be done at the end of 06.
Mr. Salpeas, you know, something that I didn't read, the article left me with the impression that the people would be concerned about being on the train and being taken into the tube and being inconvenienced with going to another station and coming back to the station to which they originally intended to arrive. But this line in the report here, I don't know, this wasn't in the article. Is this accurate? The station stopping accuracy rate is greater than 99.99%? That must have got left out of the article. Is that accurate?
That was left, yes. I personally talked to the reporter about it. I don't know. But, yes, the accuracy as designed was to be 3/9 after the decimal, 99.999. That is what we designed, and that's what we accepted. The Palestine finished the testing, and we accepted it for all the stations in the red line, and that was the decision of stopping.
So our goal is to get to within a thousandth, effectively, of the issue, and we're right now within hundreds. So, I mean, contrary to the tone of what I read, we're not really in a catastrophic position here in any way, are we?
Absolutely not.
No. Okay, thanks. Mrs. Hardy.
Do we have the understanding of the number of times you need to go to another station and turn around? Happen to be on the train that stopped, and we kind of had to wait a while. How many times do we have to actually bypass the station and come back in the number of
years? Cousins, I don't know. Jim Hughes and Steve Files know those numbers. I don't.
The station stopping, we do not have any incidents where we actually have to bypass the entire station over the next day. It was portrayed as an inconvenience, which resulted for the five complex amendments related to the change hands, including getting back to the station. The typical station overrun is by a door leak or half a car. We had some instances where you overran by two cars. They're concerned because folks like me worry about the state circuit rooms. But we've not had incidents where we skip stations because of quote station over.
And I guess I had one other part that I'm not sure was clear in your answer, and that was I think you were asking about the number of times that we've had this. You described to us that this sensor is the key piece that was identified as the problem and that you have found a way to correct that.
Right.
Is that still where we are in understanding of approaching this problem?
Yes.
Rather than a constant degrading of this and we can't do that?
No, Ms. Scott, that's what I said in responding to the chairman, that the fix have been engineered, have been tested, and have been accepted for the red line. The red line stations now we can go tomorrow if we want and put the software in our rail car. What we need to do now is we need to finish for the rest of the lines and then go and do a massive installation, and that was the plan all along. We've been testing for a year every night. Any of you, some of you know around the night, between 1 in the morning and 4 in the morning, we always are trying to go back and forth and we're testing the precision and stopping. And in regard to your first part of the question, the primary train control system is responsible to stop the trains at all times when they are in automatic operation. Because of issues throughout the railroad, we felt 3 years ago when we started studying this system that we need to back it up. And this fix is a backing up the original system of the train control in order to minimize, absolutely minimize the station overruns. That's
so the information that we've heard before is exactly the same that you're hearing today, and it's a 5 and a 6 that got lost.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Mr. Deegan.
Last year when you came to us, you gave us a figure of, I think it was a neighborhood of 33,000 stops before this occurs. Is that about right?
About 33 or
35,000
stops a day.
Same 30 stops per day.
35.
That we do. Because I remember the following weekend I was in town, and you know, hey, I called you. I wanted to know what the odds were for a board member seeing a station overrun, you know, while riding the system. But it was also my understanding that you have three sensors. And if we missed the first or the second one, by then the train operator would stop the train.
That's the five sensor.
Okay.
Get 100% precision stopping, I'll leave that open for discussion. But in any event, you have to go through, like I said, if you're a good problem. Precision stopping, there's wayside loops that have to be looked at. The interface board and the engineer has to be tested. And okay, with all the tools, you still have to, the operator is still responsible to control them. If you miss the PSS, the first sensor, the operator, our operating protocol says, hit up ATO stop button and take the left control in your hand and stop the train. That's what happens. The train is failed. So that's definitely what they're taking out. Before the engineering, there's going to be an engineering on the wayside, and when you're looking at the operating control, you keep the operating control.
So the operator is able to stop the train.
Absolutely.
Even if it,
absolutely,
the system doesn't.
Yeah, I was explained to the reporter along those lines. My thing was, this is a three-leg stool, like Steve said. The one was what we're doing with the software, the board. The second is the wayside, which the maintenance people have to maintain the coil and the loops and everything in perfect shape. And the third, the most important, is the operator. And I said, all of us in our cars, we have an automatic cruise control. And when we go on the highway, we put 60 miles per hour. However, at all, every second, we should be in charge of our car. And if we see a light coming up, we are not going to let the cruiser go through. We have to take control of the train. That's what we say.
Mr. Deegan, the PSS inside baseball, that's program station stop.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you,
gentlemen.
Okay.
Thank you,
Douglas. Moving on to the other side of the house, which are bus performance indicators. Again, things are pretty well stable there. The rate equalizes that, albeit decrease and increase in collisions. The rate pretty much stabilized. It should be important to note that 61% of those accidents were non-preventable, meaning that the only way we could have avoided those accidents if we had kept those buses in the garages. It does show a favorable trend, though. We are going in the right direction. We're moving away from onboard passengers and passengers boarding and alighting our vehicles, and we're moving outside that area into the area of traffic and pedestrian safety. And that's where our focus has been. Again, using a risk management model, we're focusing on with a interdepartmental, interdisciplinary team taking a look at that. And because our pedestrian incidents are, they're costing us, they're not only tragic, but they're costing the authority an awful lot in terms of litigation. And we're looking at some of the models out there, some of the approaches, and we're going to be looking at in the coming months speed checks, meaning road supervisors actually getting out of their vehicles and staying at known high-volume locations and monitoring the driving performance of our operators, speed checks. Also, we're going to pilot a program called Vigil Systems, where they actually, you can randomly put these cameras on a selected buses, whether it be high-risk operators or anywhere really, and it monitors the driving performance behavior of our operators, and then they can be used by the training department to reinforce training that may be lacking in terms of executing turns, because most of these are occurring in the front right side of our buses.
Could I also add that the campaign that Ms. Hudgens is very involved in is at Street Smart. We participated last year and also will participate this year, Fred, where we actually do hand out the brochure in multiple languages to pedestrians about pedestrian safety.
Because, you know, it has worked. In the past, we had problems with crosswalks in our stations. We repainted them, put stop signs up, and that pretty much eliminated that hazard. In addition, we put guards on our rear wheels, and that's eliminated most of the undercarriage incidents involving persons alighting or boarding our buses, or particularly exiting our buses, the rear door. Put interlocks, engineering controls that actually prevent the bus from rolling. We had a severe, you know, serious fatal accident with rollaway buses. That doesn't occur anymore because the interlock mechanism does not allow the bus to roll while the doors are open. So we're taking a multi-pronged approach. Also, the TCRB, which is the Transportation Cooperative Research Program, has just selected Parsons Brinckerhoff to do an industry study on traffic pedestrian safety. So we've signed up to join in that study, that survey as well. So that's 6 months off, but we're hoping to learn something in the industry, what they're learning in terms of pedestrian, because it is obviously an industry problem. We're also taking a look at the mentor program and having people like Bob Miles serve as coaches for high-risk operators so they can learn from one of their own. Having driven a bus myself, although it'll be 34 years ago, it is invaluable to have a veteran who can have one person go 35 years without an accident on a bus, preventable accident, and others that have multiple accidents, and we need to know why that's occurring. So we're taking that approach, and also we're looking at incentive program recognition. You know, that's something that's been lacking over the past few years, and so resurrecting some of those safety performance recognition programs that we used to have 4 years ago that went by the wayside, and I think we need to beef that up too. And it doesn't cost a lot of money, but it does recognize and give the underachievers something to work toward in terms of being safe drivers.
Mr. Deegan?
Fred, I was glad you mentioned that we were using people like Miles. And there's one statistic you guys don't mention. The number of drivers we have that have driven a million miles without an accident keeps going up, too.
Yeah.
So we do have a lot of good people out there driving these buses.
And it's always that 5% that get us in.
Well, yeah, I understand. But and it's also important, I'm glad you mentioned that we're going to start rewarding those people. We definitely have to reward the good performance of the drivers.
Mr. Dean, I'm sorry. Were you?
I'm back.
Yeah, let's see. You know, it's interesting. Again, you know, the numbers to the people involved obviously are very tragic or important. Certainly at best, but the numbers do again seem to be fairly de minimis. Any data on other cities in terms of collisions per million vehicle miles?
We're on the tops in terms of our rating goes. In terms of performance, we're up there. But as you say, you get those celebrated cases that bring all the negative light on us. And you can say, yeah, we can assure our passengers that they'll arrive at the destination 99.99% safe. But it only takes that one catastrophic event that brings us all down. We take one of those fatalities is one too many, and that's been our mission is to focus on eliminating those, and we're doing it systematically. So as far as the bus on bus accidents that are occurring, you know, even with our bus drivers getting injured, with the airbox injuries on the knees, whatever, boarding, the lighting, the engineering control, the administrative controls, we know that we have some work to do to improve those. But the good thing is we're moving into the outside environment, our operating environment, which is pedestrian traffic.
Can you characterize that out of all the, Mr. Hughes? Yeah, how many bus systems are there in the United States? Yeah,
I don't know.
I mean,
it's hundreds.
Hundreds.
Yeah,
hundreds. Out of all the bus systems in the United States, would you say that on for safety record that we're in the top five?
Oh yeah, but we're usually held up as the model transit property.
Okay, well, I think that's important to know. Please continue.
The next one is a metro access, but we need to underscore the fact that this data is based on LogistiCare's performance and unacceptable performance, and we're hoping we've been working with MV on their safety side in terms of they do have the cameras on board and working with their street supervisors as well as retraining all their staff. So time will tell in terms of how their performance is. I don't want to rehash what LogistiCare did or didn't do. As far as industrial accidents go, OSHA reportables, I just got the update on Tuesday. The national industry average is now 12.8. They reconciled their records. So where we thought we were higher at 11.4 versus 9.4 for the rate, incident rate, we're actually now favorable. Theirs was the industry average is 12.8. and ours is 11.4, so we're still holding below the national average. Tragically, of course, we had the fatality back in October. One of our track structures employees was fatally injured when he and his crew had unauthorized access to one of our revenue service tracks. And we've had a we've taken a stand for safety, and we're processing almost 60% of them that have been gone through retraining. Down about 3,300 employees are going through recertification training on right-of-way safety. And that's been going three classes a day, almost 6 days a week. So we'll probably be done by the end of February with that group.
Mr. Green, Ms. Hutchins.
What's your follow-up in terms of enforcing the safety rules? For example, I understand that there are some procedures when you're in that track area. And when one is reported to have violated that, what happened?
Yeah, well, Steve Field, you know, he can embellish on it, but yeah, as far as stricter accountability on the side of supervision, what was lacking in this case was a lack of supervision. And albeit they were all trained in right-of-way safety, bottom line is the supervisor of that crew is responsible for the safety, to show the safety of their crew while they're working in that particular environment. That's been shored up. Unfortunately, you know, the supervisor of that crew was terminated, and discipline is will follow for any rule infraction. It's not alternative discipline anymore. As last year, we were looking at alternative discipline, which is tantamount to a slap on the wrist for something as serious as that. For safety violations, now it's time served. You know, if you do break a safety violation, you are suspended.
Well, let me see if I can be more graphic, and because I guess what I'm looking for, I think we want to prevent any kind of tragedy. And so the rules are written so that we actually want to enforce the fact that safety is very important. And I just use an anecdote where I was in a secure environment. And when the Marines came around and found that you hadn't secured the place, you didn't get, it was clear. So in your mind, you knew something very tragic was going to happen to you if you failed to do that. And I guess I think that we need to articulate that such that we are enforcing it not only there, but it's an understanding that that's the enforcement that we have.
Yeah. Mr. Field, please go ahead and sit down, because you know what Mr. Bartlett talked about earlier. When you're standing up, I don't know that the mics are picking you up.
Thank
for the.
Thank you. Thank you.
We had an unfortunate accident in October, and again, unfortunately, it pointed to a series of violations, not because we didn't have the rules and regulations in place, because they weren't followed. Unfortunately, for that reason, employee supervision was dismissed. And we said that we needed to look at the policies, see A, if they still make sense, number one. We've done that. And immediately instituted a safety stand-down that Fred talks about. We covered roughly 2,000 people. What the safety stand-down does is reinforces all the policy procedures with regard to track access. And they're very sternly written. And there's no deviation from the rules and regs with regard to access. It can't be, just as you spoke about the Marines. Any slight deviation will give you cause to seek alternate employment.
And I think that's very important.
Also, they're not allowed to use the emergency access gate, which they used in this particular scenario. And we have also, they're required to set up barriers now. You see those orange fences that actually demarcation of where the work is being held to isolate them, even more so a barrier. So,
thanks.
As far as the car workers' comp, again, the risk management model following there, we've done a lot to eliminate all types of, and we're focused on head to toes. We've done, eliminated pretty much. If you look at years ago, head, eyes, feet, and now knee injuries, and focus for this year and next year, backs. Backs are on the leaderboard in terms of the biggest claim cases we have, back-related, and stress is an emerging claim as well. But, you know, we've been panning for gold, and we've got a few nuggets, and quite frankly, I still think there's some gold to be had in them there hills. We've already, through aggressive subrogation recovery, over $800,000 there. Light duty modified work program, we've already saved $214,000, so that's $1 million right there, and that can be beefed up as well. But and we plan on doing that, continue doing that. But the cost coming down on a per case basis, and we're going to continue our aggressive march forward. And you can get it. I've asked our internal audit department, Auditor General, to take a look at the financial operations and controls that our third-party administrator, make sure there's some costs that aren't there that we're ignoring, based on the performance of the previous third-party administrator, which I we believe that we're in many cases mismanaged our claims. They were into claims processing versus claim management. I've asked Jim Stewart's staff to take a look at some of the management controls that our current third-party administrator, see if there's something that can't be done, tighten controls, and see if there's any cost recovery options there where it's financial-based. Just being aggressive.
Mr. Deegan?
I have to ask one question. You said the claims for stress-related injuries are on the rise.
Yeah.
What job class do they fall in?
Bus operators. That concludes my report.
Next, we're going to switch over to our Transit Police Department report.
Good morning. This is the first opportunity I've had to appear before you since the report on crime. So I want to direct your attention to the form that we have traditionally used as long as I can remember to report crime, but encourage you then to switch to the next page, because based on what I heard you say, we've included now this top section is what was on the previous page. The top section is what the other agencies took on our property and reported to us. The second part is what was on the previous page, and then the third box is everything combined. That said, and I'm reporting on crime for the total of 2005, crime was down. Metro Rail, with or without the other people's reports, it's 6%. In the parking lots, with or without the other police department's reports, it was 17%. With the other police department's reports, crime on buses went up 15%. Without the reports, it went up 13%. So our Part 1 crime was down. It's up in the area of robberies. That's a trend that this region is experiencing. Unfortunately, because our crime is so low, you know, at the most, we might have 13 robberies at one particular station during the course of a year, and that's during the course of a year. So it's very hard to look for patterns and trends. That aside, we still do look for patterns and trends, put people out in casual clothes, try to work with local jurisdictional partners to set up details to do something about those robberies, and we'll continue to focus on that as a goal. One of the other things that we did, I thought it was important to let our customers know. And I would ask my colleague, John, to go to the videotape. No, we thought it was really important for our customers to see for themselves what type of crime we had. And so we've really enhanced our website. And what you have to do is go into how to travel, and then you go into safety and security. And some of the things that we've added, I would go down to the regional law enforcement agency links. You can now go into our website, find out what type of crime we have. And then if you want information about your total trip, i.e. once you leave our property and walk home in your neighborhood, you can go right into the websites of the local police and get that information from the folks responsible for preventing and solving those crimes. Let's go back, and we can also refer to some of the prevention information that we've included. Go down. Yes. No. John, that was...
Go back.
Mm-hmm. Go back. Prevention, auto theft for sure, for instance. So you can go on and get crime prevention tips, and in fact, it was updated this week. Our folks were out this week handing out crime prevention information, particularly about your electronic devices. The gals were out front handing these out, and if you didn't get one, I'd encourage you to do so. You know, we did have the case of the iPod. We were successful in solving that case because the iPod had been engraved by Apple. You really have to get your iPod engraved by the manufacturer. But this little sticker here you can put on a device aftermarket and then register it so that we would be able to identify your item to you. If you go back, John, I want to go into the weekly Metro Rail blotter, which is the second one. So here you can go on and see the crime that's reported to us yourself. And I just thought it was really important for our customers to see for themselves what type of crime is reported to WMATA, and then additionally the crime reports taken by the other local police departments are on our website as well. Really, it is unheard of for police departments to post the reports that other people take. So our website, just like our police department, is really, really unique. And in fact, Lisa suggested that we enter it in some type of contest. And Acting Deputy Chief Webb is here and went to a meeting in Maryland and asked the questions, do other people, because there are other entities that are very similar. In Montgomery County, you have, you know, Rockville and Gaithersburg, smaller police departments, where Montgomery County does come and take reports. And Dave Webb did ask if anybody else posts the reports that other police departments take. And no one had, but because we said we were going to do it, people were very interested in looking at that and may now follow our lead. So we're very proud of the enhancements to the website. I feel it's a real opportunity for us to communicate directly to our customers and provide the kind of information that they might want to use to decide, you know, how to take a trip on Metro Bus or Metro Rail.
Well, if I can, just compliment the chief and her staff on what they've done. We come quarterly to the board, and we give statistics, and you see a page with numbers on it. And there is a lot of stuff behind that. Polly and her staff have found a way to share that information with whoever wants it, both for our information and from the other jurisdictions. So I think we've made a big improvement in terms of how it is. We still come once a quarter and give you statistics, but there's an awful lot of data behind it, and it's available to just about anybody.
Well, note again, in terms of perspective on the issue, on the rail, you know, roughly one and a half times opportunity in a million to face a crime in Metro Rail. I mean, that sounds pretty safe to me. I know what my odds are in the lottery, and I've never won, so it's pretty good. Metro Bus, less than one in a million. It sounds like we're doing pretty well. And would you characterize it on the same order as Mr. Gadeen has characterized our safety relative to other systems across the country? You know, there being hundreds of bus systems, multiples of rail, and we are certainly in the top five in the crime world as well.
Well, absolutely, and I think when you look at the other departments, obviously New York is enormous and so much bigger than we are. And then if you look at the folks that are smaller than we are, you take a couple of them and combine them to make us. And I think one of the things that you have to see is that our ridership continues to grow enormously, and we're still able to keep these figures relatively low. And I think that some of the prevention efforts that our officers do, and probably an outcome of some of the high-visibility terrorism patrols and other training that we've provided to both our customers and our employees and our police officers about looking for suspicious activity have probably contributed to further reductions. So we're pleased, and once again, we're very concerned with bus, even though it is so low. We have had increases. We think that's come from additional contacts that our officers have been required to make with bus operators, but then you know we've also asked for additional resources so we can deal better with that to ensure that the bus passengers and operators are getting the support and prevention that they need.
I just want to go back to this aggregate report because I do appreciate you doing it this way, and it I guess kind of reaffirms our conclusion that we've had generally the information that we've needed in terms of what was happening with Metro, and that the other pieces are, while important, it does not skew what we've seen before. For example, as you look at now the other agencies, we see very minimal that is missing from that.
And that's why we thought it was important to include the O4 information.
Yes.
And if you recall, I did remind my colleagues, and certainly they saw the articles, as did their crime analysis staff, that they did have a responsibility, in fact, an agreement with us to exchange information, but you've not seen a tremendous, you know, difference there. So. And if this is a format that's agreeable, then we would continue. This is the first time we've done this, but this seemed to make sense. So if this makes sense to you, then we'll continue to report it in this fashion.
That's fine.
And the data that we're getting from the other agencies is still consistent in terms of the reporting.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Hughes. Mr. Dean.
Yeah, Chief, before you leave, I had an opportunity to go through that website last night. You know, it was a great temptation. We're probably giving more information than we should, but it's always that temptation to look through there, since I live up in the northern end of Prince George's County, to say, well, what happened to Greenbelt here at 2:05 in the morning? Or, you know, but I know it's asking a bit much to put that out, and I'm glad we're doing it, is what I'm trying to say. But I was also glad to learn the difference between a Part 1 crime and a Part 2 crime. As long as we have that on the report, I think it clears things up considerably.
Yes, those are FBI categories, and of course, Part 1 is very, very serious. A lot of Part 2 crime is actually self-initiated enforcement activity, where police officers go and issue citations for urinating in public, drinking in public, those type of activities.
But I like the report.
Thank you.
Mr. Hughes?
Next, Mr. Chairman, we're going to do our Metro System Performance Report for the quarter. It's for the second quarter of FY06, October through December. The reason I have to look that up to get there, and to remind you that we do our performance two ways. First, on how we measure our performance, and go through this, and also from a customer perspective as we do our survey, how they think we're doing. And I've been joined at the table by both Jack and Steve. This is the time I'm going to go through the page quickly. We'll do rail. You can ask questions, Steve, or I will answer your questions. We'll go through it that way. I think it saves a little bit of time. Highlights on the rail for the quarter from a service perspective, our performance continues to improve. Calendar year 2005 was a good year for us. The quarter, second quarter ending in December, our on-time performance, our mean distance is up from the quarter before. We're on our way to meeting our forecast for the end of the year for each of those. Safety and security is continuing to trend downward. You saw some of that in the previous report. Customer satisfaction, down from 90 to 88%. Statistically, that's probably not valid, and we're still above our goal. Complaints continue to be down, continue to carry more people. So from a rail perspective, our performance, as we measure, continues to improve. If you look at the second page, the customer satisfaction, actually talking to our customers and doing the survey, we continue to remain very high at 88% in terms of customers that are satisfied with our service. And that follows the trend from the first quarter as to where we are. And that's our report on rail. Questions on rail? Move bus. Metro bus, our service provision in terms of mean distance continues to increase. Lost trips continues to be down below last quarter and heading towards our goal. I'd like to point out that this quarter we've got new buses operating out there. Primarily this quarter is the CNG buses in 4 Mile. So we are retiring our oldest fleet, we're bringing in a new fleet. We're expecting these numbers to continue. This is what we should see. And as we move forward, we're seeing good performance with our new buses. So those numbers are going to grow throughout the rest of the fiscal year. Safety and security matches the numbers you've seen on the performance before that. We've got passenger injuries are up slightly, and that's where our focus is on. Customer satisfaction, again, dipped a little bit, but our complaints are down. Some of that tends to deal with people's reactions about what's happened with the weather, what they've read in the paper, or all that, but we are still fairly high in terms of customer satisfaction, and our ridership continues to grow. Overall satisfaction, as I mentioned, is at 73%. These numbers, again, are very similar to last quarter. Jack, do you want to give an update where we are on buses, maybe?
I give two updates. One, as Mr. Hughes mentioned, that as the new buses come in and the old buses go out, the performance should improve. And in January, our mean distance between failures was 6,377, and our lost trips dropped to 352. As of this morning, we have 155 of the compressed natural gas buses on the property. 115 are in service. 113 of those are 4 Mile. Hybrid buses, 38 are on the property. Six more came in this morning, 12 in service at Vandover and 10 in service at Montgomery. So both of these are performing at 6,000 or 7,000 miles, even during the break-in period. Very comfortable with both, and as we improvement comes not as much with the new buses as getting the old undependable buses off the street. So we're, this progress is being made, and we think all the new buses will be in service by early April.
Right, so I think generally bus is a good news story. We're bringing forward what we said with the new buses, and things are becoming realized in terms of performance.
Are there either national surveys of satisfaction that APTA might do, or the other cities around the country performing similar customer service surveys?
Donna, you need to come up to the table because of the mic. I apologize. Donna Murray is the person that does the customer satisfaction, does all of our surveys. She's been up here before. Appropriate to answer that.
Good morning. Most of your major properties do customer satisfaction work. Unfortunately, everybody does it differently. There isn't any standard at the current time for customer satisfaction work in transit. There is no one who does it the way we do it with continuous monitoring. People who do continuous monitoring are doing panel, and there's a lot of debate within the research industry whether interviewing the same people over a period of time is a good idea or a bad idea. It really depends upon how you want to look at it from a research perspective. So there isn't anything that we can out directly compare. There's a lot of numbers that we could look at, but none of it would be an apples-to-apples comparison.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the information.
Next, mode of transportation is our Ellis. And for the quarter, we've had improvement in terms of our escalator performance. It's actually improved in availability and the distance between the failures. The elevator performance has dropped slightly. We're still above our goal, but we've done some major elevator rehabs at some stations that have brought that number down. Sort of anticipated it. We also had some problems at Pentagon Station and at Forest Glen that brought those numbers. The problems at Forest Glen are behind us. We're still working on the problems at the Pentagon, so that haven't quite gotten to the bottom or the root of that particular problem. Safety figures, as Fred mentioned, they're moving in the right direction. We're still trying to get them down from an elevator, an escalator perspective, but they are mostly not geared to the equipment. There's slips and slides and those types of things, and wearing the wrong shoes and whatever on the equipment. And our satisfaction on elevators and escalators still is at the same level. It's still low. Our customers' perception of our performance continues not to be where we want it to be. But even though our performance is improving. So it's still a work effort that we've got to do, and we're going to probably wait until the end of the spring, get more people out there, get a couple more major escalators back in service. We're probably going to do an effort with our customers to say, here's what we've accomplished. We're coming forward to the operations committee, E&D committee first, and the operations committee as we move into the next phase of the escalator contracting program later this spring. We've finished 181 of the escalators have been rehabbed. As we said we do, with another 35 under contract, and we're ready to come forward with the next set. We've done about 90% of the escalators that are exposed, we've done a rehabbing. So we're going to bring that information back to this committee later this spring.
You know, on the escalator front, Mr. Hughes, I just really got to say, I mean, it's somewhat unfathomable. I'm watching a kind of a parallel repair going on in another industry right now, just to see, because, you know, the Shady Grove situation has entered the sublime in my mind. And we shut down an escalator, and we take it apart, and we put it all back together and rehab it. Just on Monday afternoon, I was in Lake Forest Mall in Gaithersburg, and they had an escalator torn apart, kind of like we do. I mean, the treads were all out and everything. It was down to the guts on the thing. And I haven't gone back, but I got to believe that at that mall, that 4 months from now, that is going to be a problem. In fact, if it's like that 4 weeks from now, I'm going to be astonished. And I still cannot make the connection between why in the private sector, the places we encounter with escalators, we don't see the same type of ratio for time and repair. Now, the rail, repairing cracked rails, I understand that. We're open till till early in the morning, and we open earlier in the morning still, but there's only a couple hours to repair. But the escalator, we literally take out of service and wall it off, and it's there, and we can work on it as many hours a day as we wish to, I suppose. What is the difference?
The primary difference between what you see happen on our train and you would see in a mall or anywhere else that you see most public escalators is happens to do with the exposure to that we have to the elements. And as we open up an escalator for all the rehabs we've done the outside, the first thing they find, they look for and find, is structural problems. You don't find that in internal escalators, because they're not exposed to the elements. So as they pull all that machinery out and they look at the beams, they look at how the structure underneath it, every one of those has had a structural improvement done as we do the rehab. And that was why the board and us moved forward with the canopy program. It will help that. There's still some exposure out there. It will make a big difference. But as you look for an escalator, you and I ride an escalator, and they do a rehab, you're right. They're probably back in a number of weeks, as opposed to 4 weeks is a lot. 2 months, 3 months to us is our standard, but it starts with a structural problem. We've had it on almost every one. So they've got to get in there, they've got to take part of the structure apart. It then has to be manufactured. We don't know what the problem is until we take it apart, because we don't know. You got to take it all apart to see it. And even when we do the inspections, you can see rust and you can see other problems, but you don't see the structural problem behind it. It's our biggest time issue, because then we've got to go order, they've got to be manufactured, they've got to be put in place, and that's not the stairs, and it's not the motors, it's the structure underneath. I don't know whether that helps. I'm willing to take you out to the first next one we take apart, and you'll see what they find in there. But that's the difference between us and the local that you see in a mall. As we move to the next phase of escalator rehab, it is inside escalators. Some 400 of them, roughly 400 of them, I think, is what's coming next, and they are all between the mezzanine and the platform. We don't anticipate those problems.
Well, do we have problems because, in a suburban station, we've got the canopy in large part over the main escalator coming up the mezzanine platform. But there's a problem beyond that in so much as our canopy doesn't cover the whole platform. And we get bad weather conditions. I mean, is there a problem with the products that we're using on the platform to take off ice and such? I'll tell you, I just had this at a building that I'm associated with. We have a ramp on the front. And after a number of years in the ramp, you know, we get ice or snow, and the guy threw calcium chloride out there or whatever. And just last summer, to our chagrin, found out underneath that all the steel superstructure that was holding up this wooden ramp was like lace. Mm. The salt had corroded all the metal. And so we repaired that and replaced all that. And the directive to the landscape people that deal with that now are, you don't use calcium chloride on our ramps anymore. You know, the sidewalk's fine, but on these ramps where we've got steel superstructure, we're using sand or something different. I mean, do we have a chemical problem maybe at these locations, particularly on the outside stations where we put a product down that then gets tracked into the escalator and that chemical is exacerbating the corrosion of the system, as opposed to just the weather, the fact that it's outside. I mean, there's a lot of escalators outside. I mean, you know, they're at Camden Yards, they're at FedEx, they're everywhere, but those places don't necessarily have a situation where they have to put down chemicals to get rid of a product, and then it gets tracked into the system. Do we have a chemical problem?
We may. We've in a number of instances, shifted from the salt base to a sand product, and we have found that helps. We still have a major water problem underneath almost all of our escalators. I'll look into and see where we are with getting rid of salt completely. We can do that where we control everything in our system. Some of them we cannot control. Our street at Judiciary Square, we can work with the Memorial Police that are out there as to what they put around. But generally, we just take care of the apron right at the top. People are still cracking it in.
Now, I mean, certain chemicals and metals just don't work.
I'll look into that.
Okay. Jim, I'm sorry, Mr. Barrett.
In terms of, do you keep a daily and running count of escalators at our service?
Yes, we do.
What would be the average percentage?
We are averaging about.
First of all, how do you do that? You have some kind of. I mean, how do you know when they're out of service?
Right now, we have a manual system. When someone takes that system, if it stops itself, an alarm goes off. Station manager must go check it. It turns itself off, and we report that. So and if we take it out of service for repairs or rehab or whatever it is, it's all calculated in there. We're currently in the process of putting in an automated system, a remote monitoring, so when it automatically goes out, we'll track that. We're on schedule to have that up about.
Pardon me, you feel confident, though, that the station managers report these service instantly, or?
I think they do a pretty good job. I got to tell you, I found some that weren't reported, but most of the time now I walk up to a station manager and say, that escalator's out, when was reported, who took it out. More than 95% of that data is accurate. I found a couple where I walked up and then said, well, it happened before my shift. I call OCC. There's a report there someplace, but generally it's good data.
And what's the average number? How many escalators do we have?
588 escalators.
588. And what's the average number that's out of service in a day?
Generally between.
For whatever reason. For
generally
repairs,
between 40 and 50 a day. Some of them are out all day. Some of them are only out a short period of time. But during the day, somewhere between 40 and 50 are out. Some of them are maintenance, too.
Is that rather high in terms of the industry? I mean, with other systems, is that 40 out of 500?
It's higher than some of the.
7-8%.
It's higher than the industry standards, partially because of the number of hours that we run during the day. We cannot do a lot of maintenance at night, so we are doing maintenance during the day, and that's what's driving our numbers up. In terms of the amount of time they're out for breaking down or having a problem, that's pretty close to the industry standard. But we also do we do maintenance during the day, both inspections and regular maintenance, and that takes it out. Whereas if you go to the mall or you go to the airport, they tend to do it more in off hours.
Well, what would it take to get that number down? Is it inevitable that's going to be that way?
We're doing something.
I think I get a lot of complaints about escalators. People, 10 can be running right, and one doesn't run right, and that's what you get. You don't hear about the 10, you hear about the 1.
We are beginning to, two things we're trying to do. We are beginning to transfer some of the maintenance that we do with our own workforces tonight, at nighttime. A few years ago, we stopped that practice because of our inability to keep a workforce. So we've trained our workforce.
Wait a second, Pat. You couldn't get people to work at night?
Well, we did, but the problem was that 5 years ago, all the people, we do our work at night, they found that they could make more money working for the local union, fixing other escalators, because they all paid premiums to work at night. We weren't doing that.
Well, I know some folks who are working at night.
We changed that. I mean,
we changed all that.
We changed that about a year ago. So
we changed all that. We took care of.
Is it working?
The pay issue, and we brought our workforce in, and we've now switched about a third of our work back to inspections and our daily work back tonight. We're working towards getting the rest of it up at night as we get our workforce back up. So I think we've taken care of that. We're getting there. It'll improve. The other reason why our availability is lower than the industry is these massive overhauls that we're doing, where we take them out for 8 weeks, 2 months at a time, and then do the next one. So we're taking a station out of effect for almost 6 months. And that's going to continue through our system for quite some time as we catch up on that maintenance.
We do all the repairs and renovations ourselves.
All of the renovations are done by contractor. In terms of the daily maintenance and the repairs that we do, it's a split between us and the contractor. We do about 60% of it now, and the contractor is at 40%. We're gradually bringing more of that in-house.
Jim, we operate, if you need to speed this up, you hire more contractors. I don't know if that's an option or not. So I'm sure you all get the same kind of complaints about these escalators. The length of time it takes that they're out, or the breakdowns. But I thought I'd just raise it, see if we can't figure out a way to take that number down.
We can investigate what it would take to bring that number down and where we think we're going with our existing programs and compare the two and bring that back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Coffin?
Just so I clearly understand, Mr. Hughes, with the 588, you said 40, 50 on a given day.
Roughly on a given day.
Out of that, how many are actually escalators that break down that are not ones that we deliver to take out of service? How many of that 40 or 50 ones are actually?
I'm going to make a total of 45 because I think that was the last number we brought to you. There's roughly 13 of them that are affected by a major rehab, and that includes whether it's being rehabbed or it's being used as a walker. So there's a pair, we count that as two being out. That totals 12 to 13 on a given day. Of the remaining 30-some that are out there, about 20 to 25 of those are for scheduled maintenance, whether we're doing the maintenance or we're bringing the local inspection in and we're bringing it back up in service. Roughly 15 to 20 of them are incidents that happen during the day.
You could stop there, because that's because if I was just listening to what was said earlier, I would have thought that 40 to 50 were out because of breakdowns. But what you're now telling me is it's really like 15.
It's like 15 a day. Where we have something that happens to shut the escalator down. It could be a complaint incident where we get there within an hour, it's back up within another 20 minutes. Or it could be something that's major.
Mr. Deegan.
Mr. Caldwell pretty much covered what I wanted to do. But when our people, they complain to what, station managers when the escalators are down?
Our customers?
Yeah.
Yes, a number of ways they complain. That's the first.
Except for me, I call you.
Yes.
But a lot of times, can't the station manager just basically turn the escalator back on if it's shut down for safety? Or something like that?
No, the station manager cannot turn it on. He can recycle it. If it comes back up, it will come back up. But if it is tripped by a safety cone, you actually must get into the system, check, find out what's wrong, and then if it is just an adjustment to the safety cone, which is relatively simple, he'll turn it back on. But the station manager is not qualified to do that, both by local code and by our own practice and procedures.
Well, you just said if they recycle them.
They can flip it like a light switch. Flip back on. If it goes back on, that's fine. But if it doesn't because it was triggered by safety, it's got a safety switch inside that they cannot get back on.
Yeah, I mentioned that because I watched one of them do it one day, and it came back on. Everything was fine.
It's always the first thing, you know, hit the side of the TV, see if it comes back on.
And when that happens, is that recorded as a failure of that escalator, or we turn it on and let it keep running?
It's recorded as an incident. There's probably no time associated with it because the operator goes, the station manager goes and turns it back on, and it wasn't down a period. He doesn't know how long. Bell might have been off for a few minutes, but that's not necessarily a downtime.
Okay.
Chairman, just a short comment. Mr. Coffin, you were asking about the differentiation between those that were up for just stopping and those that were being repaired. I'm sure you know this, but to the public, it doesn't make any difference what it is. You know, it's still a high number for them.
Okay. That is correct. That's why we report it off. The last performance indicators I wanted to go through today is Metro Access, and I'm going to go through this quickly because Spread says this is for the second quarter, and this is all logistic care information, so I'm not sure it's really relevant to spend a lot of time on it. We have been doing Metro Access updates. Go to the next page, John. We can do this. We've got some things in action. You get daily reports in terms of performance and what we're doing, both in performance and complaints. And I was kind of expecting Pam to be here. I'm not sure I can answer a lot of questions on this. I'm sorry, Pam. All right. But generally, this is our quarter. I'm not sure how much time you would like to spend on it, but we can answer any questions you've got.
Okay. Don't appear to be any this morning. So with that.
We're fine.
Yes.
Okay. A quorum.
With that, we've got a quorum present, so we'll move back to the action. We'll move on to the action item. So we'll move back to item two on approval of the minutes of the previous meeting. Is there a motion to approve the meeting, the minutes from the previous meeting?
So moved.
Moved by Mr. Deegan. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Coffin. Any further discussion on the item of the minutes? Chairing on the questions called, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the motion is agreed to. With that, we move to action items. We'll start off with 4B, if there's not
objection. I would be willing to move A.
Okay. Mr. Coffin, we'll move item A. That's fine.
Second.
Second by Mr. Graham. Any discussion on item A, request for public hearing for elimination of regional Metrobus bus routes 9B and 10B? Chair, hearing no discussion. The question is called. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the motion is agreed to. The next item on the agenda is the DuPont Circle Art Project, item 4B. It says Mr. McBride. Is
yes, it does. Here? Michael here? I'm sorry. Thank you. He is here. So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Motion by Mr. Graham. Is there a second?
A second.
Second by Mrs. Mack. Any discussion?
I just have a discussion.
Mr. Graham.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry that Councilmember Barry has left the room. I was going to acknowledge him. But I just want to say how excited I am about this project that we've been working on for several years. It seems longer, but it has been a long time. But Mr. McBride has really made a difference in terms of his steadfast support for this recognition. And what this is a recognition of is the very early response in the HIV epidemic by caregivers and volunteers who responded at a time when very little was known about this disease and a great deal of uncertainty and fear was associated with this disease. And this is one, I think it's the only memorial that I know of in the country that will honor those early efforts with some very, very fitting poetry. And we have the poet laureate from Howard University, Ethelbert, and of course he will be joined by Walt Whitman, and some very important lines that Whitman wrote, which are very appropriate. So I don't want to take up a lot of time on this, but I do want to say that for people who were involved in the epidemic early on, this is a very meaningful recognition, and I'm very pleased to have sponsored it. And I'm very pleased to see that it's coming to fruition. I want to acknowledge Tony Gittins, the BC Commission on the Arts, who has come up with the funding, or nearly all of the funding for this. I know there's a matter of a bench, which I think we can figure out the funding for, a simple bench. And so this is very exciting, Mr. Chairman, and I would hope that the committee would support this and move it to the board.
Just one clarification. When you said that we can figure out the funding for it, you were referring to we, the District of Columbia?
Yes, I think so. It's the District of Columbia. I never say we to include you, Mr. Smith.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion on that item? Chair, hearing none, the questions call. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes have it. The motion is agreed to. Mr. Coffin.
Before Michael slips off, this is some point you can get back to me on the case of the missing Huntington penguins. They continue to be missing. So this is some point. Give me a call.
Huntington Penguins.
Huntington Penguins.
I'll give you a call.
Okay. If there's no further comments, there's no further business on the agenda. If there's no objection, we'll stand adjourned and meet as the board.
This is unheard of, Mr. Chairman. This is unheard of. Can't we just talk for another 30
minutes? No, I hope not. Without objection, we stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.